hold on. I'm going to eat this Sour Patch, this one last Sour Patch Kid real quick.
Okay. Important.
Otherwise, I'd be tempted the whole time, you know? It'd just be a problem.
Yeah. No, I get it.
Okay. I am going to now take a sip of water, and then I'll be ready.
All right. Here we go. Welcome to the bookstore.
It's like a book club, but we actually read the book.
I'm Becca.
And I am Corinne. And it is September still, but we're looking ahead to October already because that is how time marches on. And for October, our reading challenge is to read a book set in or about another world or dimension, however you wish to interpret this. I chose a book that plays around with like two different timelines, and that book is called Present Tense Machine, and it is by Gunhild Oyehag. That is the book I have chosen. You can find it at your local bookstore or library, or you could choose Becca's, which I believe is on Hoopla, and Becca's choice is...
Yes, my choice is Babel 17 by Samuel R. Delaney, and that is on Hoopla, I believe actually in audio and in ebook, possibly. So, options. And that one is set, I think it's set like on a spaceship and they're going to different worlds.
You know what?
I think.
It's good enough for me. And if you don't want to read either of those, you could choose something else, either, you know, from your own library, or you can check out our challenge on the StoryGraph. It's the Bookstore Challenge 2023, and look at October's prompt and see what other people have added and what we have added that we think fits it. Let us know what you're reading for October. You can share it on Instagram and we'll share it to our story. We'd love to see what everybody else is reading, so that we can add them to our TBRs, and Becca might read it and I never will. I'll just be very aspirational. But
I love to make lists.
I know.
Making the list of books that you want to read is good
I
enough.
I accidentally, like a couple months ago, I stumbled upon this list on the internet when I was Googling Christopher Priest novels, and it wound up on this list that he had created for The Guardian. It was about slipstream novels, which is like this not quite genre. And then I wound up buying like 14 books. Not really 14, but like maybe half. I bought like 5 books, and I was like, had these grand plans to read all of them, and I'm failing. I'm gonna get back into reading here. But anyway, we did read this week, and it was my choice for the September prompt, which was to read a book with an animal in the title. And the book I chose was Gorilla My Love by Tony Cade Bambara. As always, content advisory and spoiler warnings for this episode can be found in our show notes. This is a book of short stories, so it's hard not to talk about what happens in the stories if you're concerned about spoilers for that. That's just the way that it goes. I think you can find probably some of these short stories to read online on their own without, you know, having to purchase the entire book. And I would suggest checking out a couple of them if you can find them, at least. But anyway, the safest bet is always to read the book first. Our content warnings, like I said, will be in our show notes, because we don't always know exactly what we're going to say on the episode. You can check it out there. Gorilla My Love was first published in 1972. I think both of us read copies that were published in 1992. They were published by Vintage Contemporaries. This is a collection of short stories set in New York, and some of the stories are set in the rural South. The characters are children, senior citizens, actresses, college girls, mainly people who are, perhaps financially disadvantaged, if you want to use like a sanitized term for it. A couple of like biographical notes about Tony Cade Bambara, or maybe just one. She worked with Toni Morrison. Morrison was her editor for a while. She was very strongly championed by Toni Morrison. So we love that. And that's kind of the literary style, if you will, of these, same kind of vein. But excellent, I thought. But we'll get into it. So what did you think overall?
Yeah, I liked this. I do think it's funny that I know you mentioned a book with an animal on the title in the title is not, it doesn't really give you much about the book, you know? It's nothing to do with genre or subject or anything. But both of the books ended up being so good. The Book of Goose was great. This I loved. I do want to talk more about the style of writing, but mostly what I want to do, and I could spend the whole episode talking about this, but we won't, is her preface.
Oh yeah,
that Bambara writes.
So excellent. And honestly, I kind of want to read. I was thinking, like, could I get away with reading the whole preface out for on the episode?
I wanted to.
Let's do it. I'll do it. Do you want to do it or should I?
You read the first paragraph, and okay. I'll read the second.
All right, here we go. This is from A Sort of Preface, which opens this collection. It does no good to write autobiographical fiction because the minute the book hits the stand, here comes your mama screaming, how could you? Oh, God. And I should also preface this preface with I'm extremely white, and so I'm not going to try to read this in any sort of vernacular way. And that does not do this preface a service, but it does. You know, that's just the appropriate way to do this.
we do what we can because we think it's so important to read this preface out loud. So we're doing our best.
Okay. So it does no good to write autobiographical fiction because the minute the book hits the stand, here comes your mama screaming, how could you, and sigh in death, and where is thy sting? And she snatches you up out your bed to grill you about what was going down back there in Brooklyn when she was working three jobs and trying to improve the quality of your life, and come to find out on page 42 that you were messing around with that nasty boy up the block, and breaks into sobs, and quite naturally, your family strolls in all sleepy-eyed to catch the floor show at 5 a.m., but as far as your mama is concerned, it is 1940 and something, and you ain't too grown to have your ass whipped.
And it's no use using bits and snatches, even of real events and real people, because even if you do cover guys, switch around and change up, because the next thing you know, your best friend's laundry cart is squeaking past, but your bell ain't ringing, so you trot down the block after her, and there's this drafty cold pressure front the weatherman surely did not predict, and your friend says in this chilly way that it's really something when your own friend stabs you in the back with a pen, and for the next two blocks, you try to explain that the character is not her at all, but it just happens to be speaking one of her lines, and right about the time you hit the laundromat and you're ready to just give it up and take the weight, she turns to you and says that seeing as how you have plundered her soul and walked off with a piece of her flesh, the least you can do is spend half the royalties her way. So I deal in straight up fiction myself because I value my family and friends, and mostly because I lie a lot anyway. So when I read that, I was like, this is one of the greatest pieces of writing about writing that I've ever read.
And
I was
just going to say, I think it hits extremely hard because currently, like, a lot of the fiction, especially like literary fiction, is very well. And no, you know, I'm even going to go so far as to say, like, sci-fi and fantasy too are very much like write what you know kind of stuff, and very auto-fiction-y in a lot of ways, stuff that like really can very closely follow the author's life. And I think that is a fine way to write, but sometimes I want to read, a lot of times, most of the time, I want to read something where the person is just like, here's a scenario with some people, and I just want to watch the way it spins out. And I just appreciate that so much more than having to like sit around and wonder what part of this is from the author's life. What is their experience with this? You know, it's just, that's so much less interesting to me at this point.
Yeah. And I also think there's like, there was a thing, I mean, at this point, probably a few years ago, where some writer was like writing a story and it was so very clearly about another writer in her writer's group. And there was very prominent well-respected, well-critiqued, you know, critically received authors who were saying, like, every single person I've ever met, you know, I've turned them upside down and shaken everything I could out of them, mm-hmm. essentially saying, like, every single person, you take what you can from them and put them in your books. And they sort of, a lot of authors sort of acted like, how dare you not want me to put you in my fiction, anything. And I think it's so, it's just like the ability, the fact that Bambara was like, no, I understand. I don't want to do that to people that I love.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. It just feels so totally different than what we hear today, and so much more like respectful and just kind.
Yeah. And that's not to say that some of this isn't stuff she knows. Obviously, like, most of these books take place in New York City somewhere, some in Brooklyn, probably the Bronx, Harlem, etc., which I think are all places that she lived in New York. So it's not like that part of her life in, like, her experience isn't part of this, but she's not, yeah, she's not using, like, specific people or characters, and I appreciate that. And I also appreciate her addressing it in this way, because I do always think about that, especially for memoir. Like, how do you go and show your face around the people you wrote about again? But yeah, I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, I think the whole, like, write what you know thing has gotten, like, so overblown, because it's like, it would be like if somebody goes to write about, I don't know, Ming Dynasty China or whatever, and they don't know anything about it.
Yeah.
Like, don't do that. It's going to be poorly written. Like, you need to know about the subject that you're writing. And, you know, with a lot of the problems is people want to write about character, they want to write about characters, and they don't actually know the type of person.
Yeah.
In real life, who they are trying to write about. And that's where the problem comes in. I feel like was never meant to be, you only can write about experiences that you personally have had, you know? Yeah. But anyway, so yes, that's exactly it. Like, she knows about growing up in New York City, probably.
Right.
But we don't have to think about how, oh, she must have been a track star and she must have done this. Like, I don't know. Who knows?
Right.
It doesn't really matter. And I think it helps that she writes about so many different people, mm-hmm. that there's no way to really pick out who she might be or who she isn't. I don't know. It just is. It's so nice to read something like this.
Yeah. Let's start with the first story, which I think was maybe, I think that story might be my favorite from the entire collection. I know a lot of people really, really love the last one in the collection too, the Johnson Girls, which we'll talk about later. Mm-hmm. But the first story is called My Man Bovan. I'm going to assume that's how that's pronounced. But it is basically, it's narrated by a woman, Miss Hazel, and she is at a kind of like political fundraising function sort of thing, I think. I don't know if it's fundraising or just, you know, community, grassroots, whatever it happens to be, get the word out about this political activation. Mm-hmm. But she is there. Her children are there. Her children are adults, and they are very embarrassed about the way that she is behaving with a man from the community named Bovan, who everyone is just kind of ignoring because he's blind. But she is having a great time chatting with and dancing with, and they believe that she is being kind of forward, I guess we will say. sexually forward.
not acting her age.
Yes.
Like, her skirt is too short. Her
neckline is too low.
Yeah.
And she's touching him, and they're touching each other, which part of it is because he's blind, you know.
Yeah.
Part of it's because they're adults and they can do what they want, but yeah, I don't know. I loved her voice in this. And one thing I thought at first, I was like, oh, God, she is so good at catching the voice of people, because there's this line in here where she says, shaky bee, bottom lip all swole up with sweet peach, and me explaining how come the sweet potato bread was a dollar quarter this time instead of a dollar regular. And he say, uh-huh, and he understand, and he break into this thizzin kind of hum, which is quiet, but fierce some, just the same. if you ain't ready for it. And so I put some emphasis on fearsome because I've heard people say fearsome before. And I always thought it was just them not saying fearsome correctly. And I was like, she nailed voice here. Like, she picked up on this like bit of language that people use. But I Googled it and fearsome is a word.
Yeah.
Either way, you know, it was one of those things that I was just like, wow, there's a real like character's voice for you.
Well, yeah, I right away, I mean, her voice is so clear and good. Like, the line that I liked, so Miss Hazel is in the kitchen and the kitchen's dirty. She said, and it was, and it just me in the stranger's kitchen, which was a mess I would never let my kitchen look like. Poison you just to look at the pots. Yeah. That is the most incredible way, because you know how disgusting. I just love that when you can see immediately what something looks like just by one sentence.
Yeah.
Is like, poison you just to look at the pots. I love that.
But also, I just loved her. I mean, I think we've talked many times on this podcast about how we like reading about older women particularly. And I loved this. It made me feel sad partially because like her family is just trying to kind of like, you know, hide her under a basket or whatever because they think she's too old to be behaving the way she is. But also she's just like, no, I'm going to still get what I want out of this. Whether that's just like, you know, platonic companionship from this guy, or because she does take him home to have sex with him. Like, maybe it is. Maybe it is about that. Like, you know, who cares? And I just,
yeah.
I liked her a lot.
There's a, this is not really about any story, but one of these stories, I can't remember which one, somebody mentions, somebody calls a movie theater or cinema a movie house. And growing up, I always called movie theaters and especially movie rental places, movie houses.
Oh, no kidding.
Let's go to the movie house and pick out a movie. And it felt like, where did I get this? And other people I knew said it too. Anyway, that was just a point. I was just like so tickled to see it come up in this book because I never, since I was like a kid, I have not heard anybody refer to it as a movie
house. Well, I think that's the thing about fearsome too. Like, now that I know that it is a word, you know, it's not as, but I mean, either way, like if you say a word and you, your meaning is understood, even if like, you know, it's not in the dictionary or whatever, that is technically a word. That's how linguistics work. But like, it's just one of those bits of like language and paying attention to language that like completely, I don't know, that it just draws a much more clearer picture about the character. It's a very specific language choice, I think. So yeah, that like movie house, when you get like down to these like very particular, maybe, you know, regional dialect or word choice kind of situations. It's, I don't know. I love reading stuff like that.
Yeah. And one thing, like every single story has its own such a clear voice. There's one specifically that is totally unlike, like really, really, really unlike any others. But we'll talk about that later. But I do want another story I really loved was Raymond's Run, which is about a girl. I can't remember her real name, but she's called Squeaky. I don't know if they mention, I think it mentions her.
Yeah, because real name. She gets her name from the, she gets her number from the guy signing her up for the race. But
yeah. Oh, yeah. But anyway, she, oh, her name's Hazel.
Oh, is that?
Also.
Is it also Hazel who's in,
nope, they're also Hazel. Yeah, Gorilla, Miss Hazel in the first one too.
Yeah. Oh wait, baby Jason comes up in another story. Anyway, yeah, so I was not doing a great job of paying attention to characters' names, but some of these do follow like the same families at different points.
Yeah.
Oh, I think it was Maggie of the Green Bottles that's got baby Jason in it too.
Oh yeah. But yeah, Raymond's Run is about this girl, Squeaky, who's training for just a track race. I think it's some kind of like, a May Day festival. Mm-hmm. So she's going to run in it. And she's got her rival, Gretchen. And so she's like, I don't know. It's so fun because she's like walking down the street with her brother, Raymond. And they meet up with these girls. And she's just like, the girls are like, no, Gretchen's gonna win. And then Squeaky's like, I'm going to win. And she's so completely confident the whole time. And the one guy who's like, I can't remember what he is, principal or something, Mr. Pearson, he like asks her, he's trying to get her to agree to throw the race.
Yes. So that somebody else can win finally or something. Yeah.
Yes. Because she wins every time. And she doesn't. She wins. And then there's at the end, there's like sort of a kerfuffle. They're not really announcing who won at first. And then in the end, she's like looking at her brother and she's looking at Gretchen, who got in second place. And she just like all of the rivalry like goes away.
Yeah.
And it ends with something that I do really love, because she does earlier in it, her mom kind of, she thinks about how her mom wants her to dress up like a flower and just dance around the maypole instead of running, because being an athlete is not very like feminine of her to be. And she says, maybe, because she's good, no doubt about it, talking about Gretchen, maybe she'd like to help me coach Raymond. She obviously is serious about running, as any fool can see. And she nods to congratulate me, and then she smiles, and I smile. We stand there with this big smile of respect between us. It's about as real as a smile as girls can do for each other, considering we don't practice real smiling every day, you know, because maybe we too busy being flowers or fairies or strawberries instead of something honest and worthy of respect. You know, like being people.
Yeah. And there's a part earlier in the story, too, where I think she says something that's echoed there, where she says that she doesn't know how to smile to other girls because no adult woman has ever taught her, because no one ever taught them, kind of something like that, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's just such a, I mean, I don't know how to say this without sounding a little bit corny, but it's like, this is what patriarchy took from us, right? Like this idea that girls and women have to be in competition and have to be a certain way to get through life. And a lot of times, like, it's not even like your fault. You just sort of have to. I don't know. And this just made me think of like, that's all she wants, is she realized like, oh, this girl's good too, and I'm good at running, and we both have something in common. And she wants to bring Gretchen in with her brother and like her family, basically. And all they want to be, all she wants to be looked at is a person.
Yeah.
Not necessarily like, oh, well, you're a you know, a feminine girl first, or what have you. It's just like, just let me be a person.
And also with an interest that she chose and one that wasn't, you know, picked for her.
Yes.
She does a really, I mean, obviously, like, I think she nails most of these personalities and the feelings that the characters are having. She does a great job with young kids, too, in the way that they can feel about things in the world and how they can be really like observant about things in the world, and how, I don't know, just like how sad sometimes it can be to be a kid. I don't think you had marked it to write about, but Happy Birthday, like just absolutely devastated me. It's first, it's, you know, it's about this little girl who's just kind of walking around, her, you know, like maybe her block kind of, and she can't find anybody to play with her. She's just bored and everyone is either sleeping or gone at work or whatever, or they're the older boys in the building and they're all just sitting around and nobody wants to play or do anything. And she just, she finally just goes and she yells something out in front of the church, and somebody yells out at her like, hey, stop doing that. And she breaks down. She's like, and she's just like, it's my birthday, and just like starts sobbing in the middle of the street. And just, I don't know, just like that one just broke my heart completely, because like there are those feelings when you're a kid where you're like, oh my God, this day is like the worst, is so long, it's so boring, there's nothing to do or whatever. But then like to add on that thing where it's like, it's supposed to be the day that's special for you because everyone's always told you that your birthday is a special day, and then it doesn't go the way that you want it to, and that's just like extra devastating.
Yeah.
And even if you're trying to be tough the whole time, you know, you're trying to hold it all together and be tough, but then it just all falls apart on you. That one just, I don't know, that one really, really got to me.
I know. I think that might have been why I didn't mark it, because it is so sad to me. I mean, it also kind of speaks to like the loneliness you can feel as a kid. And I see a lot. I mean, I don't know how much this happens in real life. I read on the internet, okay, like parents writing in about why their kids are doing this or acting out or doing that. And a lot of it is like, I think they just want attention. And it, every time I read it, it's like, yes.
Of course they do.
Like, of course they do. Don't we all want attention? Like, we all want
and
attention.
Need it. We need, yeah.
Especially a child when you are just growing and you don't really know how to deal with like the sort of loneliness that comes with being a person in general. Yeah, that one was really like sad.
I know. And I mean, I think a lot of it too is just about, it's also about like the environment that she's growing up in and stuff. So like, while I can't really relate to that, I can't, you know, like I can still feel those feelings of just like, not being able to reach anybody when you're trying like so desperately to just, you know, have someone be around and want to be with you. But yeah, I don't know.
Just,
yeah. That one really made me feel. So
I also, talking about Sunny was another very, very sad one.
Yeah. They progressively get darker. And then the last one is, you know, a little bit more hopeful, but yeah.
Yeah. Talking about Sunny is basically some guys talking about Sunny, who does he actually, he murders his wife, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's really tough to read because in the end, it's it's told from the perspective of, I think, is it like Delaney's girlfriend or something? I couldn't really tell what their relationship was.
I don't know.
She wasn't his wife.
Because she's like a social worker too, I think.
Yeah, but yeah. She's like taking care of his kids, yeah. Like in his house. It was a bit odd. But anyway, like he's just sort of like, oh, well, you know, it's not Sonny's fault. Like something came over him,
yeah,
that you just couldn't control. And it's one of the things that like I think is sort of the scariest thing is this idea that you can get so angry or upset that you're not in control anymore. And it's not your fault.
Yeah.
Hey, it's not your fault.
Yeah.
And it is definitely something that you see in like toxic men, you know. Mm. Oh, well, I just got so jealous. I couldn't help it. You know what I mean? Like, it's a thing that like feels like we're giving excuses to men. Like our society is not made to like tell men that they need to control themselves.
Right. That one was pretty dark, especially because, yeah, I mean, I don't know. Like when you do hear about crimes or hear people talking about crimes and it's not like specifically about the victim, like, you know, being a victim, it's a little scary. Like, you know, you can talk about the ways in which like the system has failed people. I think that's probably, you know, a big part of it. And maybe that's what this guy is trying to get at too, right? Like, these are people who are living in a world and in a system that's like completely stacked against them. But, you know, his outlet shouldn't be at his wife or anybody else around him necessarily. But yeah.
And the fact that she was like, you know, it was probably my concern for Beverly and Arlene, the children, more than for Sunny, that made me wonder about Delaney's unconcern.
Yeah.
I don't know. And so it makes me feel like she was sticking around because Delaney has two daughters, mm-hmm, and she's sort of there to maybe protect them or just make sure that they're okay. I guess we could take a second and talk about the fact, I don't know, I have my own like in my head what different genres are. Uh-huh. And to me, a lot of these were very modernist, mm-hmm, which can be super difficult for me to understand.
Yeah.
What's going on.
Well, I think part of it, so like
Survivor.
The Survivor
was so hard.
The biggest departure. I had to read like a summary of it to understand what was going on because it's been a long time since I've done Stream of Consciousness. And are huge chunks of it that kind of are more or less just Stream of Consciousness. I had a difficult time with playing with Punjab, but I think that might have just been because of the vocabulary. mm-hmm, it was written in a much different way than I speak. And so I think I struggled with that one. But yeah, The Survivor is definitely like a huge departure from the style of the rest of these books. And I was really fascinated by it. And I really wanted to understand what was going on, but I did wind up having to go back and reread, and then I read a summary of it. So do you want me to explain it to you?
Yeah. Well, let me. So, does it go back and forth in time?
Yeah. So she is on a bus at first, and her name is Jewel, and she is 9 months pregnant, and she's on a bus headed to see her. I think her grandma, maybe Candy. It's a family member. Either way, Candy is an older woman. She's on a bus, and then while she's on the bus, different things remind her of these things that she has experienced. So that is in just regular text, but then also there are these chunks of italicized text that are like full on like memories that she's had before. So there was a car accident essentially with her husband, and he may or may not have survived, and it may or may not have been real. Jewel and her husband made films, and it sounds like they had a very bad relationship, and it sounds like there was, again, a car accident, and I think she is, quote-unquote, the survivor, but she goes to have her baby at her grandma's house. So we're going back and forth between, like, all of these situations in which she was with her husband and things are going badly. There's a scene where she's having extremely terrible, like, morning sickness, and he just, like, takes off because he doesn't want to be there anymore with her.
Yeah.
In different stuff. But, like, as I was reading it, I was so confused because I thought there was a part where she stabbed him or something, or somebody was stabbed. But I think maybe that was just the car accident. I have no idea.
Yeah, that was it was hard for me to tell when she was still on the bus, because it sounded, I think there was also some memories of her going, old memories of her going to visit Miss Candy.
Yeah. Yes.
And so that was a little bit hard. And then I couldn't tell. I thought that she had finally left her husband.
Yeah.
And I couldn't tell if the car accident was real or if it happened after she had left him.
Yeah.
Or, yeah, that was something that I got confused about.
Yeah. I don't, it is pretty unclear. I think, but
yeah, yes, that's stream of consciousness, like modernist stuff is sort of like in my, maybe this is wrong in my head. It's like so highly like intellectual, like with about sort of like philosophy of the brain and what people are talking about.
Yeah, and
kind of like that one Bessie Head book where much of it was concentrated in what somebody was thinking about. That I can't think like that.
Right.
Well, you get confused.
You have to be paying like extremely close attention, which is not something I am good at the moment. I'm not very well practiced in any longer. My attention span sucks. But yeah, you have to be paying such close attention so that you can, when you notice something a little bit later, you can go, oh, right, like that connects back to this thing. Or, oh, right, that must be what that was before that I didn't understand. So, because like nothing is spelled out for you, unfortunately. Which, you know, there was a time in my life when I loved reading about, you know, or loved reading that. I loved William Faulkner, like above everything else. Thought he was a genius. So, yeah, that's definitely got that going on there. I don't know. I think she did it pretty successfully. I would have to go back and reread it in a time when I have more time to spend on it so that I can tell. But I don't know. I think it was really interesting to see a piece like that mixed in here with the rest of them, though.
Yeah, that's what kind of what I mean by like every story feels very different from the other one. It just feels, and that was one of them that is so very, very different. And if we were going to actually talk about it in depth, I would have had to go back and reread and probably make some notes to myself.
I considered it, but then I didn't expect that we were going to be talking about it at all necessarily, except to say that maybe it was very different than the rest of them, which I guess is kind of more or less what we're doing. But I was going to go back and reread it. But yeah, no, I agree with you. I haven't read a lot of short stories lately, but I did pick up one like maybe a month or two ago now that had been on my TBR for a very, very, very long time. And while I think that the short stories in it, I'm not going to name it, but I did think the short stories that were in it were good. Like, they were all very, very much just like told first person in a very specific way, in a very specific voice, even though they were all different characters and all different stories, to the point where like they all started to seem exactly the same. And so like that got to be very annoying. I think like in order to have a really successful short story collection, you know, that doesn't just end up seeming like, you know, here's a bunch of stuff that like I have published over different literary magazines and et cetera over, you know, the last several years. Like, you gotta have, I don't know, it's gotta be varied enough in order for that to be like a good, enjoyable reading experience for your reader if they're gonna sit and read this through like a book. So, yeah.
Yeah. And I also thought too, I'm going to drag modern writing again, contemporary stuff, is that these short stories, they don't spell anything out. Like, we've read other short story collections for the podcast, which I won't name, but a lot of them felt like, okay, these were written with one theme or one moral lesson that you're supposed to get from it. And these ones are just so much more sophisticated than that. It's like the lesson, which you start out. So it's these neighborhood kids are like kind of taken under. They get a new neighbor, Miss Moore, who's like very sophisticated and professional. She kind of takes them over under her wing. And well, actually, I should say it says she has proper speech and no makeup. So she's kind of like this and that. She's like professional, but also she's not like overdoing anything, I guess.
I think she's maybe an intellectual.
Or academic, that kind of thing. She takes these kids under her wing, and I think at first I started to feel like, is she trying to sort of teach them kind of like respectability, you know, quote unquote? And then by the end of it, or like to teach them to strive for more,
right,
or something like that. But then by the end of it, I realized, no, what she's teaching them is what inequality
class
is.
Consciousness.
And it's such an amazing, like, I don't want to call it a twist, because like, I mean, it's not a mystery thriller, but it just does such a good job of like flipping what I think this story is about. And it's doing it from the view of a girl who is just like has to be the cool one, and above all of these lessons, and she can't show her real emotions. And yeah, it's just incredible to be able to do all of that in one story.
It's also a great way of subverting that character. And by that character, I mean the new lady, Miss Moore. What's her name?
Yeah.
Moore?
Yeah, Miss Moore.
That she, you know, like that idea, like a lot of the times it's kind of like this school marmy type who just wants you to pay attention and do everything right in order to, like you said, get ahead in the world or whatever. Like, hey, if you just behave right, we can get you up out of this, you know, what we're living in now, right? Like, you just, you know, just follow the rules and it'll be better. But it's like a complete subversion of that idea and that trope of that character. So, yeah.
She gets at the end, they go to FAO Schwartz, and of course they're all like transfixed by these toys and also the cost of all these toys, because these kids are paying attention to what these things cost. And then, this one girl, Sugar, says, then Sugar surprises me by saying, you know, Miss Moore, I don't think all of us here put together eat in a year what that sailboat costs.
Yeah.
And Miss Moore she says, Miss Moore lights up like somebody goosed her, which is like, again, what a great turn of phrase. And we know this is coming from a little girl who's like not really trying to show that she's into it. But I don't know. It's just so smart.
Yeah.
And
I mean, the predecessor of those tweets that are like, it would take you, you know, 18,000 years to make what, you know, Elon Musk makes in a year or whatever.
Or like whatever. I know the union, the UAW, it's like, how long would it take them to work what one CEO
makes in a year?
GM makes. Things like that. I mean, that also is like, nobody said anything first, okay? There's always somebody who said the exact same thing decades and ago.
No, but it is, you know, with the last couple of weeks here and months, et cetera, especially when we're talking about like labor rights and stuff like that, it is that one was a, you know, apropos.
I want to talk about Sweet Town, which is one of the most like endearing, just charming stories, I think. So this one is, this girl is 15 and she is, I think she's like sort of like a precocious genius.
Yeah, she's a gifted theater kid.
Yes. And she's going to be going to college like as a young teenager soon because she's so smart. And like she wrote one day, she writes notes for her mother,
this is like,
and she wrote, "Dear,
so manic pixie dream girl," but like in the way that I just kind of find, you know, like I do find it to be really endearing.
Yes. Yeah. She says, "Dear mother, please forgive my absence and my decay and overlook the freckled dignity and pockmarked integrity plaguing me this season." I don't even know if I know what that means. But her mom, too, is just like, "My dear, mad, perverse young girl, kindly take care and paint the fire escape in your leisure." And it's like all the I's were dotted with marmalade. The T's were crossed with orange rind.
Because she wrote it in frosting. Yeah.
It's just so like, yes, it definitely has this like movie quality, but it's so,
it's
charming to read.
Exactly
that.
The like definition of like romanticize your own life type of TikToks.
Yes.
And also like main character energy. Like this is that.
Yeah.
No, I
well,
love
and
this
she
one too.
Her name is Kit, I believe, and she has this friend, BJ, who she really likes. And BJ always has this friend, Eddie, who's like just hanging around.
And repeating everything BJ says. Yeah.
Yes. And eventually they kind of are making plans to leave. And then BJ is like, "No, I'm leaving with Eddie. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm going to go." And she's doesn't want him to. But then, you know, they do. And then in the end, she has this like, really like sort of dreaming about what could all these different paths for the future that she could take.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's like, I mean, in a way it's like, well, I don't know. To me, I just thought it was like really adorable because she is going to college at 15 years old. Uh-huh. So the world could very possibly be open to her.
Yeah, never throw your life away for your 15-year-old boyfriend. Never, ever.
Right, yeah. Right. Like, she did make the right choice. And, like, a lot of stories would have her be leaving, too, with these two kids. Mm-hmm. But she stays, and she's like, you know, maybe I'll meet him again someday, and maybe I won't. And maybe we will, and he won't recognize me. I don't know. It was just very enjoyable to read.
And it's just like the most charming way of like writing anything. But when he's telling her he's taking off and, you know, maybe I'll see you again next summer, she's like, "I wanted to say, you will bear in mind that I am great, brilliant, talented, good looking, and I'm going to college at 15. I have the most interesting complexes ever. And despite Freud and Darwin, I have made a healthy adjustment as an earthworm. But I didn't tell him this. Instead, I revealed that petty, small, mean side of me by saying, Eddie is a shithead."
So good.
Yeah.
I also like, I cannot, I have the most interesting complexes ever. I mean, like, again, you have no new thoughts. Like, there are no new thoughts under the sun.
No.
We are running longer than I thought, but I do. So I'll mention Blues Ain't No Mockingbird, which is, this girl lives with her grandma and some other kids that presumably the grandparents just sort of like picked up to take care of, like distant cousins and things like that. And these people from the city government or the county are coming to take pictures of them. And it's essentially to prove that they should take away food stamps from poor people by using these grandparents' land because they're like growing their own food for sustenance.
Right.
And things like that, kind of like saying, here, why don't you people just do this instead? They're doing fine. And so the grandmother tries to get them to stop taking pictures and they don't. And then the grandpa starts coming in. And I gotta say, I know he's a grandfather, but it is one of the most romantic things I've read. First of all, he knocks out a hawk by throwing a hammer. And then secondly, he just sticks his hand out and he's got such a presence that these county guys just give them the camera and then he pulls it apart
and hands it back to him.
Good.
And then he's like, you're standing in my wife's flowers. Goodbye.
Yes. and then Granny starts humming again and going back to cooking instead of being like sad. And I loved that one.
Yeah. Yeah. But it also made me think of the preface again, just because, like, I don't know. Cause the grandma also tells a story in it where she's talking to the kids about, like, you know, there was this time I was walking on a bridge and a man was trying to jump off the bridge and there was a journalist there just taking pictures and not doing shit to help, you know? And it made me think of the preface again, just like, hey, please don't use like other people's suffering or challenges, you know, from real life or whatever it happens to be to create these stories, or, you know, essentially just to like prop yourself up. And so yeah, that's what I was thinking about with that one specifically. But
yeah.
Should we talk about the Johnson girls? I know that's the big
yes.
one. I think maybe I built it up too much because people had been talking about it and everything I read, so I don't know if I liked it as much as everybody else did.
I mean, I liked it in that what I mainly wanted to talk about is how it's a group of women mm-hmm. who are coming together. And to be, I mean, okay, like, you know, the Audre Lorde quote, the master's tools will never dismantle the master's house. I thought of that in this story about a woman who's considering going and chasing after her boyfriend only because I think about how some people try to make like the nuclear family to be, this is the bedrock of society and blah, blah, blah. And like, really, like, it, that's wrong. Like, we're never going to do anything if we try to use that as our foundation. And just how this is like a bunch of women coming together and taking care of each other.
So you were being so thoughtful. My thought again had to do with a viral TikTok sound.
Listen,
there's this one right
that's
now.
What you're gonna get this, in this podcast.
Yeah. Somebody made like one of those filters that's like, which are you sort of thing. There's this one woman, it was this TikTok sound where this woman's like, men are either, they're either stupid, useless, stupid, useless, something, or like evil. And I was like, that's basically what this conversation is that all these girls are having together.
Yeah.
But yeah. It seemed like a fun thing. And it also, like, you get an interesting view into it because it's from the point of view of Inez's cousin, I think, maybe. And she's quite a bit younger and she's just trying to like figure out the ways in which all of these women relate to each other and how they go about it, and then finding her own place in there too, which is kind of a sweet like entry point into the whole situation.
Yeah. And to, like, I guess I was thinking of the family thing too, because a lot of these stories have people who aren't the nuclear family like really depending on each other and finding love and kindness with each other. And so that, I think this story sort of just capped off like, oh, a whole bunch of, you know, adult women coming together to fling clothes around
and talking about how men cause all of their problems. The sound is, every man is either stupid, useless, creepy, or evil. Which, like, I think there might have been one of those in that story. So, yeah.
What do you think? Do you think, what is his name? I forget who the guy's name is.
Roy.
Because they were like, he's such a great guy. And I was like, is he, though?
He does sound, he sounded better than the other ones who were, like, you know, sleeping around with everybody. But, like, yeah. And also, he wasn't, like, it didn't sound like he was abusing her. So he maybe, you know, best case scenario is like maybe stupid. You know, either way. I mean, it sucks because she like bought a whole ass brownstone in Brooklyn. She's got like this huge house. Like, she seemed to be doing quite well for herself. It's just one of those things where it's like, girl, please.
Yeah. I mean, again, it's just like, men can be intimidated by that, and women aren't.
Right.
You know, and I don't even, like, with all respects, not just like romantic, but I mean with friendships too. Like, I just don't think that's a thing.
Right.
That we really do. I mean, obviously there's exceptions, but you know what I mean?
Yeah.
In general.
Yeah. I think that probably concludes our discussion of these. Really enjoyed them. Yeah. Glad to have finally gotten around to having a reason to read it, because it's been on my TBR for a while. Specifically, Bimbara has been on my TBR for a long time. So I think I will be picking up more by her, especially now that I know that, like, Toni Morrison was part of the picture. It's like, you can't go wrong. So
yeah, no, I know. I really liked this. This was a very good pick.
Yeah. Thank you for listening to The Bookstore.
If you would like to support the podcast beyond listening, you can check out our Patreon at patreon.com/thebookstore or rate and review us on Apple Podcasts.
You can find all of the ways to contact us, email, social media, etc., are all at thebookstorepodcast.com.
And our next book discussion will be Present Tense Machine by Gunhild Øyehaug. You can find it at your local bookstore or library and read along with us.
The Bookstore is a production of Awkwardly Social Media, produced by Becky Young and Corinne Keener. Technical and production support is provided by Josh Bourdon and Zach Titus.
And John, if you're out there, thanks for listening.
See you next Tuesday. Bye.
Bye.